Welcome to The Bear and the Ball. I'm your host, Nick Webster, and thrilled today to welcome to the show Dave Simeone, the Director of Education Programs for the United Soccer Coaches. Dave, it's been a long time. We've known each other a long time, and I finally got you on the show. Welcome to The Bear and the Ball.
Thanks so much, Nick. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to it. It's great seeing you.
You too. Now, this is only an audio, though. So, although you're really handsome, Dave, and you know I'm loving looking at you right now, my audience will not get to see your beautiful, handsome face, but they will hear your dulcet tones. So, let's get straight into it. How are things in Kansas at the moment? The headquarters of the United Soccer Coaches. What's going on in Kansas City? What's going on in your world?
Well, it's the time of the year where, you know, we're just preparing for the convention. We're determining what the program is going to look like. It's pretty exciting. We've also got courses, our diploma courses going on through the summer. So it's like everybody else in football, whether you're a youth coach, a high school coach, a college coach, a director of a club, we're always doing more than one thing at a time. So it's this space where we've got CoachCon coming up in July in San Jose. We're really excited about, with two tracks there. So it's like never a dull moment, for sure.
So the coaches convention, the largest coaches convention in the world. I've been lucky enough to go for many, many years, but you just mentioned CoachCon. The first edition was last year in Las Vegas, which I was lucky enough to attend. Talk to me a little bit about CoachCon and how it differs from the convention and what may attract coaches to come to San Jose this summer?
Well, that's a great question. You know, the convention is just this huge array of 42 field sessions, 240 presentations between a Wednesday through Saturday. So CoachCon is very different than that. It's developed into two tracks. We're only developing those tracks for between a total of 300 to 400 coaches. So one track is developing a game model this year. So it's our collaboration with the Scottish Football Association. And then the second track is through the Global Institute of Sport. And it's going to be geared towards leadership. So it's a much more intimate environment. Obviously, at the time we're in San Jose, Sporting will be playing a game in San Jose, so an MLS, so we'll incorporate some of that in. It's just much more intimate, and rather than seeing a bit of everything, you're either in the leadership track or you're in the game model track. It's just a much more intimate educational experience, Nick.
So United Soccer Coaches touches multi-thousands of coaches. And you've been involved with the organization a long time. I'm not going to say how long because, you know, you still look very youthful. I don't know how you've managed to pull this off, but the air in Kansas City must be an Alexa or something. But when we look at the last 20 years of coaching in America, how do you think it's changed?
Oh, my gosh. You know, you make the observation you make about how wide the spectrum is of coaches here in the United States. Everything from grassroots coaches, high-performance youth coaches, high school coaches, college coaches, whether you're in Division I, II, or III, USL coaches. So it's varied. There are some issues across the spectrum of coaches that have been affected. But just the technology aspects, how much technology involved now in every level of the game, whether it's wearable technology, video, analysis, it's performance issues with heart rate, meters covered. I mean, there's so much technology involved in the game now that it makes you kind of wonder, where does the intuition of the coach fit in? Where does the experience and the insight of the coach fit in? Used to be that data kind of confirmed your gut feelings, and now there's so much data and technology in the game, it's like it nudges, I can nudge out, and in some instances does, the intuitiveness and the experience of the coach. So I think that's one area that's really changed. And I mean, I think our overall approach more holistically towards player development and the experience of the player, the health and well-being of players physically and psychologically, I think we're so much smarter about what overuse looks like or overtraining, where kids are, or and even pros, where they are psychologically and mentally in today's society. So I think these are two areas that have changed quite a bit. I think there's an over preoccupation right now with overarching areas, like everybody's got to have a game log. I'm not saying that that's wrong, but we're so preoccupied with the aesthetics of how the game looks. It's got to look a certain way. And I'm not sure that always plays into the realities of the players that you have and their qualities. So there are a number of issues, I think, that have changed a lot. I think in my experience as a young coach, and it was always, well, are they playing in three backs or four? Are they playing in a 3-5? Is that the way the Germans play the 3-5-2? Well, can we do that? Now it's all about the game models. And there's probably a great preoccupation with that, Nick.
You've given me so much to unpack there, Dave. And, you know, we've only got like 35 minutes, not 3 hours and 50 minutes, which probably even then isn't enough time. So let me try and pinpoint a few things there. Data versus the eye. And obviously when I look at you and I, we're grizzled old coaches, and you know, some would say if they looked at us, oh, you're old school. I look at data and I'm fascinated by the data component and can read so much into it. However, what I do find in my limited use of data is that it's sort of overwhelming, and nothing really beats the eye test. And yet, you know, you speak to some you know, air quotation experts, and they'll tell you that data doesn't lie. And as we know, data doesn't lie.
Yeah.
So, what is more important if I'm a coach? Beginning my coaching career, and of course I have data available to me, but my eye tells me something else. You mentioned intuition. Where do you think your intuition should take you?
It's a great question. I think the longer you're in coaching, the more experience you get, I think it tells us that. It screams at us sometimes about what is more important in certain instances. And every coach also has to determine what some of their core values are, how to apportion some level of significance to different aspects, whether it's technology, your observational skill. I think that's one of the things that one of the areas that technology may have stunted a little bit, which is I don't need to develop an acute observational skill and be dependent upon that, which is also related to your experience, when I can look at a readout and see meters covered, I can look at numbers. So I can't overemphasize the importance with especially young coaches who are coming out of playing in their 20s and they're starting to put their foot into coaching, is like the importance of observational skill and the importance of your intuitiveness. And you can be, that means you're going to be wrong about some things. You can make mistakes, but those mistakes are also experiences that add to what you can do in the future, in making better choices. I mean, so I think intuition, if we don't factor in the intuition and the experience of coaches, then we can do it all on an iPad. We don't have to go to the field. You know, we don't even have to go to the Euros and play the Euros this summer. We can just do it on software. We can not have to host the FIFA World Cup for the men in 26. We can just play FIFA World Cup and we'll sort it all out.
Is there a danger then that the game may become too reliant on data and AI as you describe it?
Yeah, well, we're already seeing some of the evidence of that, aren't we? I think the goal line, like the technology part of it also encompasses like goal line technology. Wow, that has made a huge difference, you know, and it's very tangible. The ball's all the way over the line. It's not over the line. But I think the infusion of all of the other VAR replays, I was just looking at the incident with, who did Arsenal play this week?
Saka.
Yeah, with Saka. Yeah. And when you slow it down and you look at it again, you go like, well, what? It looks different. It changes your perception. You know, it's so do we want to get things right? Yes. But to get things perfect, we will miss getting things right. There's a certain essence and spirit in the game that can be totally, and I think in error, dismissed. It can be dismissive. And now the game is just one replay after. And I'm not sure that's where we want football to go.
I love that statement, Dave, because you know I often tell my players, football is a game of mistakes. It's not a perfect game. And from the officiating point of view, it shouldn't be a perfect game either. And no. I think that when we look back at the history of this game, some of the great talking points to this day are over officiating decisions that changed monumental games. And that's what we love as football fans, to debate. Yep. The debate, and I think, you know, I think sometimes to your point that VAR can take that away, and it certainly takes away some of the spontaneity of what yes. is a beautiful game. Yeah. Yeah. Going back to your statement that I said we had a lot to unpack, game models, yeah. And right now we're in this moment. And the great thing about football is actually it's always changing. You know, everything has its moment. But the moment right now, and as a coach yourself and in coaching education, is playing out of the back.
Yeah.
And you mentioned something that really caught my attention about having players that can do that. And there's the fascination right now of playing out of the back, and I see it at so many different levels, and 95% of the times I see it, the players aren't capable of doing it. So why is this model taken such a grip of the game, and why are coaches insisting on trying to play out of the back when they don't have players that have the technical ability to do so?
Well, first of all, we listen to managers talk about, look, you know, I don't care what happens with my team, this is the way we're going to play, which makes me scratch my head sometimes, because we know that pro coaches, college coaches, they're in the business of getting results. So if it doesn't work in the game, I mean, does that mean you're not going to adjust and change in the game? But to your point, so the high school coach cannot control, let's say, the kind of players they get. They're in their attendance zone. The youth coach, that means that is the game model more important in the player's development as they travel through rec soccer, C team, B team, A team, a competitive platform. So I think sometimes you're trying to squeeze, you know, 2 pounds of sausage in a 1 pound bag. And to your point, yeah, it's great to talk about, well, here's, we're going to take Pep's game model. That's part of the problem. Coaches don't develop their own game model sometimes. They go like, I like what this survey is doing. Or I like what Pep is doing. And I'm going to try and do that. And they don't allow themselves any room for adjusting based upon the players they have. Every game is different, too. This is one of the hardest things I think that we try and do is to create consistency through a series of games. And every game is different. The opponent is different. The day is different. The conditions can be different. So I think we rely and we give ourselves maybe some false hope and belief until you're sitting in a chair with a high-performance youth team or a high school team or a college team or a USL team or an NWSL team, and you go like, that's not working. We got to figure out what the adjustments are. So we cannot rely just totally on this idea, this overarching idea of what the game model is. We have to be able to have the players to do it. We have to develop the players to do it, right? And some of it is it in our characteristics. Like, I think one area, and you know, when we talk about what is our national playing style, wow. You know, Germany is the size of the state of Montana. So it is relatively simple to quantify what the values are in a playing style in a country that's 5 hours from top to bottom. There's still a little bit of variety in there. It's not all the same. But in our country, what we develop all these different kinds of players. So I think the national coach's job in some way now is like, and it always has been, well, what do we want the team to look like? Where do we get the players from with some different qualities? It's a complicated process. We've seen that process change over time. But we have access to a wide variety of playing characteristics and playing abilities. So if you want the game to look a certain way, you have to get those kinds of players, whether you're the pro coach or the national coach or the youth coach, into your team to play that way. That's hard to do.
You mentioned the coach wanting to establish what his game model is.
Yeah.
But on the other side of the coin are the fans.
Yes.
And there's an interesting conundrum right now going on in England and with West Ham United. Okay. Mm-hmm. Very traditional club. Throughout the years being known as a, you know, real footballing club.
Yep.
Under David Moyes, they've been incredibly successful. Won a European trophy for the first time in almost 50 years.
Yep.
Consistently in the top 10 of the English Premiership. And yet the fans there are revolting because they're not playing the way they want West Ham to play. And yet West Ham have been very effective in getting results.
Yes.
How do you, and we're talking obviously the professional game, we'll take this back to the youth game in a second, but how do you manage as a coach or as a administrator of a club, how do you manage those expectations between winning a playing style and then trying to implement something that you can't do, which has the potential of getting you relegated?
That's a really good point. In England, you know, you can have these ideas and concepts about how you want to play. They may be attractive. They may not be very effective. And there are a lot of factors into the performance of West Ham in particular. And most of those EPL teams, players get injured. Players fall out of form. Something doesn't work out on the management side of things. That's not a good fit. So there are a lot of different factors, but the pro coach's job, I mean, you're serving two masters, West Ham, Arsenal, Manchester United, all these teams and clubs with, they have history. And when they've been the most successful and football has looked the way they've wanted it to look, well, that's the apex, isn't it? I mean, it's like, wow, that's real West Ham United. That's Hammers football, or the Invincibles. I mean, you know, with Arsenal, well, they were attractive and stylish, but they were effective. They were deadly. So if you can get both of those going, at the end of the day, I would say like the pro game too, Nick. It's like, right, win ugly a little bit, but, you know, if you're in the top four, the money is different in the EPL. When you get into the Champions League or the Europa League, than it is if you're in the 10th place and you're out of that. The money is totally different. So there's that consideration that's not only attractive, effective, but that's a business. So the fans want it all. The fans want it all. And the fan in England, whether they're an Arsenal fan or a West Ham United fan or a Newcastle fan, they love their organizations. They're tuned into their history when the football was good in their organization, and they want to see that, and they want the results at the same time.
Let's take that then back to the youth game. And here in America, it's a very unique environment where pay to play is king.
Yeah.
And we have youth coaches that make really good money. And I'll give you an example. A friend of mine runs the Bournemouth Academy. And Bournemouth, they're a Premier League team, established Premier League team. And I asked him how much he pays his coaches who run the 14s, the 15s, 16s, really high level players. And he said, oh, they're lucky if they get 30 quid a session, $50 a session.
Right.
And I almost fell on the floor and said, most coaches in this country won't get out of bed for that kind of money, and they're coaching, U8s and U9s.
Yeah.
How do we take the model of coaching in Europe and bring it to America without turning young people away from potentially coaching this game? Because we need coaches, we know that. Mm-hmm. But we also need coaches that are passionate students about the game and not looking at coaching as a way to make an income, so to speak. And I know that there's probably a ton to unpack around that as well. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, seeing it evolve over the last 40 odd years. I mean, I grew up in Northeastern Ohio. I didn't have paid youth coaches. It was very ethnic in the community that I grew up in. So it was not a profession. So I go back to when I went to graduate school in Texas at Midwestern State, and I got a huge education because Dallas at that time, between the late 1970s, early 1980s, there became this preponderance of former pros, former Dallas Tornado players, former pro players that became soccer coaches. And they just, the standard got bumped. I mean, whether you're talking about the Horst Bertels in North Texas, Keith Hodder, Dick Hall, who played at Everton, Horst played at HSV Hamburg, Wolfgang Sunholz in South Texas. So they started to apply what they had learned as players and then translating into coaching, the standards. They brought these great standards. People were willing to pay money for that. Now, the club sport in Texas at that time, as well as Southern California, I mean, there were in Dallas, there were six or seven clubs. Now there's over 200. So it's become an economy. The business end of it has surpassed, in some ways, the football side of it. And this started not yesterday. It's started in the 90s, especially the late 90s, when we started to listen to people and their message was, hey, there's a business side of this. You got to service the customer. They weren't talking about the players. They were talking about the parents. So we created this transactional kind of dilemma for ourselves now. And it's exacerbated by, you got to be in the right platform. You know, it doesn't matter to you what platform you're in kind of defines you. And that defines some of the money, too. So I'm not sure. We have to go back to our values. You know, what do we value about coaching? What is it that we can create as expectations? How do we measure the long-term effect of coaches on learning with players? And then looking at every level, but particularly when you get closer to the finished product, I look at young men and young women who are coming out at 16, 17, and 18 years old. And for sure, I mean, you can go to college and there's still going to be some changing and developing. But what are we, for as much money as is involved in the game now, and it's, like I said, it's surpassed maybe pure football interest. What are we getting for this? I think when I left North Texas to work with Tony and the U.S. women, I said at that time in the late 1990s, I thought the amount of money in the youth game in North Texas was $10, $12 million, which is staggering. I mean, just staggering. Now, I think in North Texas, like a lot of the big state associations, you know, with the number of clubs and the amount of money coaches are making, facilities, in North Texas, you're looking at $80 million. So we got what we kind of ascribed to. You know, people said, hey, there's a business here. Hey, there's facilities, there's revenue, there's salaries, there's benefits, there's travel. So we kind of are at a point now where we're looking in the rearview mirror going, well, maybe the customer, while important, we don't talk enough about the player. We don't talk enough about the substance and the essence of sport, which is athletes. So I it's going to be really challenging to put the toothpaste back in the tube, isn't it, Nick?
I think that... To use the cliche, the horse has left the barn. As the director of education for the largest coaching association in the world, what are the qualities of a good coach?
Well, we have to start with, you know, the person. And what they value. And one of the things you and I as young coaches learned, and everybody does, is that this is not an 8-hour a day job. It's if it's a profession, or for the youth coach, it's not a profession, it's an avocation. And you typically, when you look at sport, most of the training happens at 5 o'clock or later. The games happen on the weekend. All of this time, 5 o'clock and later and on the weekends, is discretionary leisure time for the typical individual that's got a, whether they're a college professor or they're working laying concrete and brick, they work 8 to 5. You know, they may do an occasional job on the weekend for time and a half, but you have to be really happy in that environment, I think. And if you're not, then I don't think you have the overall and requisite qualities to be a proficient coach. So I think you have to be willing to embrace that part of it. You have to have good intentions. And then whatever level that you're working at, have a contemporary approach to lifetime learning. I sometimes feel that whether it's licenses or diplomas or certifications, that while important to increase your knowledge base through formal education, informal education, that it is just as important to understand how you apply it, that the license, I mean, everybody here in Kansas City, which is a pretty good sized place, everybody's got driver's license. Doesn't mean everybody's a good driver. So we have to look at certifications, diplomas, licenses in the context of this has increased my knowledge base. I have a good attitude about learning. Now, how do I go out and get experience? How do I attach myself to someone that's got a lot more experience than me and be open to learning? Because once in our game, and I think baseball coaches would say the same, bad friends of mine who are basketball coaches would say the same. As soon as you get to a point where you go like, I know it all, it's about to bite you. It will squeeze you and it will humble you. So I feel like the natural curiosity that human beings have, can we stimulate that, value it, so that over the span, whether you coach, you got into coaching because your son or daughter at 6 years old needed a coach, but you're curious about things, or you're a former college player, USL player, and now you're in coaching and you're trying to decide where does this all work out and how does it fit for me? The natural curiosity and attitude about lifetime learning, I think it's a spectacular attribute to have.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, licenses and diplomas certainly have their place. I am an avid consumer of football, and my wife will say to me, haven't you watched enough? And I'll tell her, every game I watch, I see something I haven't seen before, or it reinforces something that I've been thinking about. As we wrap this up, Dave, how do listeners of the Bear on the Ball, how do they get in touch with you? How do they become part of the United Soccer Coaches?
Well, our membership is what drives the association. I mean, coaches connect with us for different reasons, but mostly when you factor in everything, whether it's the convention, whether it's our foundation diplomas or our advanced national diplomas, our premier, it's because of education they reach out for us, because we have the history, we're a trusted source of this. We've delivered education a long time. That's mainly one of the factors. The other factor is they've either come to the convention, first timers, they haven't had very much, if any, interaction with the association, and they walk away because of that experience and the people they've met at a convention. The convention and our diploma courses, because of the rich instructional staff of educators, you can rub shoulders with people you could only in any other way see on TV. Or so I think their experience that they have with education, with the convention, with CoachCon, I think that's the thing that drives them to come to the association and keeps them here. Obviously, people can find us on the web, unitedsoccercoaches.org. They can contact myself or Rob Herringer, our director of coaching education. So we get calls every day from either new coaches, coaches who have taken an online course, have then gotten interested in blended or in-person education. So we love talking to those that want to talk about soccer, about coaching, what they love about football, and how to get better at it. So that's kind of what drives membership.
Dave Simeone, Director of Educational Programs for the United Soccer Coaches. Thank you so much for joining the Bear and the Ball. And for more on CalSouth, please visit us at calsouth.com. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and X. We'll be back next week with more from Bear and the Ball.